And Walden also makes the point, look, the media mediums also make the kind of totalitarianism, the kind of authoritarianism that you're going to live within.
Which makes sense, right? Yeah.
Which actually makes perfect sense. But it's like, okay, well, think about the Paradigm Case, is obviously Nazi Germany, right? And they loved propaganda so much. But it was generally a one-way propaganda tool, right? It was the state, the party, especially because it was very much obviously a one-party state in every respect. It was the party, you know, putting out magazines or newspapers or posters or films or radio shows or whatever it's going to be, you know, directing at the general public, being able to utilize them and manipulate them effectively as a tool, whether it's to stay placid or get riled up or get ready for war or, attack their neighbors or whatever.
Here there is a single state propaganda apparatus centrally organizing the ideas that are propagating throughout their society, organizing the ideas that can be and can't be discussed in that way.
Whereas the modern version of that is more, I want to use the term organic, but I'm really hesitant to use that because I think it's more like imagine going into a garden, like a big garden, and being like, wow, there's so much like different plants and life going and stuff happening here. All these plants are plastic, right? Like it has the appearance of being very organic and of being chaotic, but it's obviously managed. But how it's managed is far more covert, right? It's, as you kind of said, the suppression, first of all, it exists primarily online, right? Like this is going to be our primary at this point. You know, it's just like at this point, you know, whether it's be Facebook has billions of users or hundreds of millions of people listen to the stupid Joe Rogan every week or whatever, you know what I mean? Like these sorts of things are the, you know, they are the most current space.
Right? Yeah. These are the spaces where motion is made. Yeah.
And so what kind of authoritarianism, what kind of totalitarianism is going to operate in that space properly? Clearly not one that operates super overtly or with forms of censorship that are, you know, like, you know, it's like, imagine if, you know, Goebbels got on Twitter, they just like started banning like almost everybody and be like, Twitter is now like the, just like the party mouthpiece, right? No one else is allowed to talk on Twitter other than us, right? Like that's obviously completely missing the point of what something like Twitter is about. But you can sort of tweak the system to encourage certain kinds of thoughts, interests, discussions. You brought up an interesting point, which was, and there's I think an extra layered version of this, which is, you brought up an interesting point, which is, you know, you can go on something like Twitter, or I'm on Reddit, perfect example, maybe even the better example, and you can see people discussing frustration with the system. You can see people discussing, you know, how we live in an oligarchy or how it's a, you know, BKP. I'm sure that we can find a discussion where a bunch of people talk about inverted totalitarianism or whatever it is going to be, right? But the thing about that that I think is really interesting is that that might itself be built into the very system that's being managed, right? It's like a recognition, okay, in inverted totalitarianism, in a managed democracy, there needs to be the appearance of dissent, and dissenters need to feel like they're participating in that dissenting process. I'm reminded of Mark Fisher, and I can't remember, but I want to say, I'm going to use the term spectator democracy, which is not, I think it's actually the term he used, but basically his point in discussing this was how, you know, one of the kind of the wind has been taken out of the sails of, you know, opposition political movements like we're talking about here. One of the ways that that has occurred is by people basically Fox participating in like opposition movements, right? I go watch a movie. I like make no sure there's plenty of movies out now or recently about how corporation bad. Right. Ironically, those movies are put out by corporations that make hundreds of million dollars on the film. But, you know, I can go watch a movie about corporation bad and go, yeah, corporation bad. And then I can leave the theater and go home. In the same way that I can be like, Reddit is the worst for this, in my personal opinion, from what I see. Where it's like Reddit is full of like kind of left to hard left leaning, progressive, you know, even like kind of anarchic ideas.
Yeah, like hashtag and resistance kind of thing.
And you know, and just like, and you know, with recently with the relatively recently with the I forget what was it, the CEO, you know,
Brian Thompson,
United Health CEO, and how he, and you know, and suddenly Reddit is full of the, you know, things praising the killer or making memes out of him and all this kind of stuff. But all of this is like participatory in the very system itself, right?
It's
it's like a space to like, it's like, oh, okay, like, we know in a kind of fake managed democracy, people need to let off steam. We're not going to tell them no. We're not going to send them to a concentration camp. They can go on their phone and get mad on the bus ride home.
Yeah, they can make TikToks about it. And, you know, it, like, people in the mainstream news, they're scratching their head and be like, man, what is this? What is the assassin's motivations? Whereas everyone at home, like, the moment that they see that guy pull out a gun, they know instantly what the motivations are. Like, you don't have, like, that's just how you read social cues, okay? Like, you know what this guy's trying to get across. You're picking up what he's putting down. The mistake that is made there, if you're a person going to somewhere like Reddit who legitimately thinks, like, why can't we do, you know, we need to start doing something with this. It's like the mistake you make is you mistake internet virality for political motion. And the mistake, the reason that that's a mistake is because the one, internet virality contains that motion, right? It's a sort of self-contained cycle where the discursive energy that is used is what is expended. It doesn't actually translate into, say, like, because, you know, like, what would that even look like? Like, calling up senators and being like, yeah, we think this was really great. Like, that's not going to happen. That doesn't, you can't enter the kind of established political institutions with motion like that. I think the significant, like, this is just a case of it, but the significant point that you're alluding to here, that people who haven't sort of figured out this medium is the message idea, or if they have, are not seeing it in this case, is that actually the platforms or the forms of media that are used to express this kind of political dissent are kind of like, they're like Kevlar in a way. They can stop that. They are meant to be a place for that to be expended and be completely impotent, right? They can contain that motion.
Yeah, exactly. And you become a spectator. You can get the feeling of being a revolutionary without, you know, doing anything, you know, particularly revolutionary, particularly risque.
And there's kind of a canadal point to be made about that, or like kind of not an evolutionary point, but like, and the point is to say, and there's a reason that these platforms are the way they are, right? Like, before, I know people, like, we talked about nostalgia on a previous episode. People have nostalgia for, like, past kinds of internet platforms. So, like, you know, the old school forum. Yeah, exactly. Like, they didn't, I think they did, like, contain that kind of stuff as well. People were not, you know, there was not like radical political action in the internet in 2004. But at the same time, it's this idea of there used to be a time when the internet could do things. There's this story that people tell themselves where on the internet things happened, or there was a kind of mystique or action or community that the internet could foster. But the truth is, the reason those were there in the first place and kind of have always been there is because you would, if you are a corporation running the internet infrastructure, and the internet does not run for free, corporate interests keep the internet running. Your interest is in establishing a platform that does not threaten your own existence, because then it would just collapse. The fact that the internet still exists attests to the platform's capacity to contain the energies that would shatter it, right? It speaks for its own existence in that way.
Especially in its current form, right? Especially when you think about, you know, and of course, again, getting back to inverted totalitarianism and the idea, and let me actually just read, there's a great little, another great little passage from Walden where he basically gives his own definition, effectively. He said, inverted totalitarianism, this is near the end of the paper, while exploiting the authority and resources of the state, gains its dynamic by combining with other forms of power, such as evangelical religions, but most notably by encouraging symbiotic relationship between traditional government and systems of private governance represented by the modern business corporation. The result is not a system of co-determination by equal partners who retain their distinctive identities, but rather a system that represents the political coming of age of corporate power. So, like, in a way, the concept is actually quite simple, but basically what Walden is getting at is that it's corporate power, right? Like, and as people talk about, there's an oligarchic kind of thing going on. Looking at, we were recording this just after Trump's inauguration, and who was, like, right front and center in the crowd? Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the lizard man, Mark Zuckerberg. That's a really interesting one because they're a corporation, but also because they're all tech corporations. Those are all three of those guys are tech dudes.
I should say, too, I just want to add also this. So the CEO of TikTok was also there. And this is because, like, I mean, he probably would have been there anyway, but the CEO of TikTok being there because essentially Trump has them on a leash.
But I think it's a two-way street, right? Like, it's, again, it's encouraging of this melding, like this symbiotic relationship. And it's like, you know, in case anybody's wondering, you don't randomly take your seats at the inauguration, right? Like they were sitting together front and center, pretty much well in view of everyone, is a kind of messaging. This is part of state power. Like, part of state power is this corporate power. And there's a lot of advantages for the state to do that, you might say, but it's clearly, again, getting back to the main point, it is clearly a violation of the traditional democratic, liberal democratic notions of the state, right? And the state's relationship with the general citizenry. When you basically create a love child between the heads of industry and the heads of state, right? And you have this sort of melding of the two. And how, again, there's a point, like, how possibly could that entity be beholden to the citizenry and make decisions on behalf of the citizenry for traditional notions of progress of whatever? Obviously, those notions of progress are going to be more about progress sense of change and rapidity of change and fragmentation, like we've been talking about. One of the ideas I was kind of thinking about as we've been discussing here is also to this, again, we're getting back to this, or I should say again, but the idea of, like, propaganda, how the state operates. You know, again, it's not going to be super direct, but it's more about directing the conversation, tinting the milieu, for lack of a better way of saying it, right? Whether that be on Reddit or Twitter or Facebook, right? Like, you can kind of, you might not, you know, have complete control over what everybody says all the time, but you can rig things to be a certain way. I mentioned to you before the episode, I told you, I said, I heard an interesting quote. The quote stuck with me more than anything else I've heard recently, which was unfortunately from Steve Bannon, who is not a great...
Usually who you get your quotes from, but...
Bannon said, politics lives downstream of culture. And if you basically said, if you control culture, then you will control the political system as well. And I thought that was a really interesting thing. And, you know, when he kind of talked about that in relationship to Trump's initial run and you know, in 2016 and this kind of stuff, where it's like, if we can get people talking about certain narratives, if we can tap into what people are already talking about and emphasize and exaggerate that, if we can get in on what, you know, people, both get in on what people are kind of wanting, what's out in the milieu, and also kind of, like, direct that process, then we can get someone like Trump elected. We can, you know, foster this kind of character, and it can be a cyclical process. And I think it's the same thing within the context of inverted totalitarianism, where you can kind of, if you, especially now that the heads of the, you know, the wide corporate interests are now also directly the media interests, you can now have a much clearer dictation, you know, your hand on the dial of the cultural zeitgeist of the conversation of whatever it's going to be. And then that will inevitably feed into a certain sort of political, you know, ostensibly voting, you know, for limited options or whatever, that you kind of want it to. You can kind of have things directed and nudged a certain way that sort of circles back and keeps the whole sort of system going. As an aside, I would say, you know, thinking about it, the risk would be that it becomes, the risk I'm talking about from those that are running the system, is that these places become so tainted, you know, and especially with this, we haven't really talked about AI or anything like that. It's not really important for this type of thing. But it's like, if these Facebook becomes so tainted, so uninterested in Instagram, you know, people basically get burnt out, then you, you know, what if your spaces become vacated, basically, right? What if people stop participating in Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or whatever? Obviously, the counter to that is that these things are made to be kind of like a bit of, like, whatever it is, addictive.
Yeah,
but like, kind of,
there's no sign that people quit Twitter because they get mad.
Yeah, no. They stay. And also too, how all these things kind of embed in each other, right? Like, you know, they become a part of, you know, it's like Facebook is a great example for things like, oh, it's not just Facebook and message, but it's marketplace, it's advertising, yeah. It's sales. They're
total ubiquity, yeah.
I think even on some of them, if you can do like kind of like business transactions, all that, like you can sort of bring, and actually too, thinking about how I know a little bit of with WeChat and how China, like within the Chinese sphere version of that, how they've effectively created a online sphere that includes everything you're ever going to need. And if you get almost everybody or basically everybody involved, then everybody kind of has to be involved because it's how everybody, you know, communicates. It's how everybody, you know, sends and receives payment. It's how, you know, people must be involved in that space. And so then if you're kind of controlling the narratives and talking points and all this kind of stuff within that space, well, then you're obviously directing and managing your citizenry in a particular way.
There's also, I'm just thinking of this now, there's an interesting way that the internet, or like a kind of mono-platform, let's call it, that the mono-platform can kind of take over everything. And that's, it can even take over things that aren't on its own platform. So I'm thinking of I have an anecdote specifically with my roommate, right? So I will be on the internet and I will see a thing. And then when I leave my room and I go down to talk with my roommate, the place where I go to talk about things that aren't the internet, since everything is mediated by Twitter, you know, mono platform or whatever, we just end up talking about what's going on Twitter. You know, it jumps out beyond its own limits in that way.
I think there's a way in which we can say, okay, well, look at how the political sphere has changed, the tone has changed over the past decade. It's augmented itself to become more memeable, basically, as opposed to the way to put it. Like, it's
more viral.
More viral, right? So it's like, okay, as we're talking now in like July 2025, it's like, what's constant on the news? Okay, well, I endlessly hear about, what is Trump doing now? He wants to impose crazy, insane tariffs that are going to, like, you know, throw world economies into like depressions. Crazy stuff. Invade Greenland. Invade the Panama Canal, right? There's all sorts of other stuff too. But it's like, whether or not these are actual serious plans or not, what they are is they're very viral. They're very talkable. They're very kind of exciting. There's no boring bills and stuff.
No, yeah. It's always, this is the content of political discourse, is just whatever Trump is up to.
Yeah. And it fits well within this context of like creating a show out of this whole process that appears to be participatory. You know, in inverted totalitarianism and in a managed democracy, the leadership, the elite, doesn't have to be aware, self-aware for that the system to function and operate in a certain way. So unlike, you know, people like Stalin and Hitler and the kind of upper echelons of the classic, like, super intense totalitarianism or dictatorships or Mao, whatever, they were very ideological. So they had a prism of ideology that they saw the world through. But, you know, but they were also under no illusions that, like, you know, like, they weren't for the... It's not like they were like, oh, yeah, actually, I am for the free press. I do free press. I do free press all the time. Right? No. They were fully aware that they were repressive, but, like, that repression was couched within the context of a particular ideology. It was justified within, like, a particular ideological reasoning, basically, right? But in inverted totalitarianism, even the leadership doesn't need to see itself as, like, oppressive. They could see themselves as open-minded, liberal, although I think that's changing. As Jean actually said right here, unlike the classic forms of totalitarianism, which openly boasted of their intentions to force their societies into preconceived totality, inverted totalitarianism is not expressly conceptualized as an ideology or objectified in public policy. Typically, it is furthered by power holders and citizens who often seem unaware of the deeper consequences of their actions or inactions. There is a certain heedlessness, an inability to take seriously the extent to which a pattern of consequences may take shape without having been preconceived. And I think that's it becomes one of the more opaque things about inverted totalitarianism, that there doesn't necessarily need to be real, like, a particular leader. There's no leadership principle. There's no, like, guy at the top, right? There might be the president, or there might be this corporate leader, that corporate leader.
Yeah, there's no great man theory here going on.
Yeah, they're all replaceable. Like, we've come the closest we have to, frankly, at least at this part of the structure, to classic totalitarianism with Trump, because there is, I think, a bit of a cult of personality there. But ultimately, as far as we understand now, like, Trump is still in the office of the president. He's not, like, the Führer or whatever, right? Like, you know, this kind of, like, specialized leadership, almost emperor-esque embodiment of the people kind of thing, right? You know, I am the state and blah, 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 right? It's an office. He's in that office. He's kind of old. How long will he be there for? Another 4 years, unless some crazy stuff happens. The system can still continue, even if Trump and Musk and Bezos and Zuckerberg and all these people drop out. Replacements can come immediately and take over the mantle, and they might not see themselves as replacements. They might not see themselves as part of that system. They might be completely delusional, but it's kind of, or like we use the term organic earlier, it kind of like organically just sort of happens as corporate and state interests become one and the same thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I don't know, this is kind of just a funny comment I'm thinking, but like, you can't not be a grifter in this, because you don't have any control. Like, you just jump on the ride because you can get something out of it. It's doing its own thing, but you're gonna get in on it.
You would have to be, I guess it's an interesting point to kind of end on the last couple of minutes. It's like, okay, well, how would you would have to be part of the opposition that Sheldon says is kind of moaning doesn't exist anymore, right? Like, you would have to be in a position where you are actively advocating for positions that go against corporate interests. Obviously, these shouldn't be, like, random stuff, but, like, stuff that's, you know, popular with the citizenry, popular with the people, but goes against corporate interests. The problem is, as Sheldon points out, is that the system is so geared by this symbiotic relationship that nobody even gets to the point where they can be in that position. Or if they are, their voice is, you know, the volume is turned down in one way.
I think another, like, kind of one just quick example of this would be, like, say you want to do something about the housing crisis. Well, one option, it's kind of extreme, but one option is to decommodify housing, is to stop private interests from running the housing markets, essentially. But that's just an unintelligible solution in our political climate.
Well, it's like seeing, like, again, kind of thinking, oh, I'm Mark Fisher, capitalist racism. It's like, you can't even see your, like, how would that, how do you even see outside of that? Like, it's, like, unacceptable. Another, I think, like, another, like, real-world example before we end, it's like, this is going to be obvious, but it's like, okay, well, who's an example? Bernie Sanders, whether you agree or not agree, is someone who's, like, openly considers themselves as, like, a social democrat, like, kind of old school, almost no dealer type. Bernie, in the 2016 obvious election cycle, obviously had a quite a large amount of momentum, and it's pretty well known at this point that the Democratic National Convention, that whole system, stifled that in favor of the much more establishment like Clinton. Obviously, because it's, you know, like, we don't want this outsider. Like, he might be a congressman, sure. Some people in Vermont vote him in, but he's an outsider. Like, he's not part of this full, and he's not going to get in position of,
he doesn't represent
actual power.
Yeah, he doesn't represent the interest of the system he's a part of.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's almost, like, he's pretty much an outlier. As we kind of close off, it's, you know, Sheldon points out, it's almost like you describe the system as self-sealing. From state to corporate to culture, it's like, you know, it has its hand in every aspect. And since every aspect sort of communicates and relates to each other, and that's how the whole sort of society is built up, well, then you kind of have this aspect of, like, full-scale control that appears to be a democracy, but is, you know, is managed by the great hand of, you know, the baby of corporate and political power. But with that, you've been listening to Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been your host today, Hale, and with me has been Brandon, and we hope you've enjoyed learning about inverted totalitarianism by Sheldon S. Walden, and we'll see you next week.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to your daily progressive news, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
What is the forest industry most afraid of? Shifting the conversation from saving old growth to protecting what's left of BC's primary forests, areas with minimal human disturbance and far greater ecological value than tree farms. Save What's Left Conservation Society is a volunteer-run group at the forefront of the movement to save the last remnants of unprotected primary forest through seeking reforms to the government agency, BC Timber Sales. Learn more at savewhatsleft.ca. Find us on social media and please support our vital work through our website.